You're listening to Packers Talk Network.
On this episode of Cheesehead Radio,
another one that got away as the Packers tie the Cowboys.
We spend the bye week discussing where the blame should lie.
And we give you our hot pockets.
All that and more, right here on
Cheesehead Radio.
Hello again, Cheesehead Nation. It's time for more Packers news, fun, and frivolity here on Cheesehead Radio. Now in our 17th year, talking about our ridiculously unhealthy obsession with the Green Bay Packers football team. As usual, our distinguished hosts tonight are C. DeAngeli of Packers Talk, known as TundraVision on social media, Kelly Hodgson of Cheesehead Radio, known as That Packer Girl on social media, and little old me, Jersey Al of Packers Talk and Cheesehead TV. You can find me at Jersey Al GBP. This show and all Packers Talk podcasts are sponsored by Wisconsin's own Ticket King. For over 30 years, Ticket King has been providing Packers tickets to fans across Wisconsin. You can find them at theticketking.com or across from Lambeau Field. For direct links to Packers tickets, check PackersTalk.com/tickets. Remember to support local Wisconsin businesses. That's it for the preliminaries. Let's get the show on the road.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Cheesehead Radio. A very interesting show. This will likely be the Green Bay Packers in a highly anticipated Sunday night football game with all of the momentum on their side. All of the prognosticators predicting at least a touchdown win. The Dallas Cowboys reeling in fear and knowing they probably weren't going to win this one, go down to Dallas with Micah Parsons ready to make a big deal to Jerry Jones. And again, an easy win that got away. This one ending in a 40-40 tie. None of us predicted that last week, I can tell you that. The highest scoring tie in NFL history. Initial reactions, guys.
Second highest scoring tie in NFLers history. At least Jerry Jones didn't win.
You used the word easy several times. There's nothing easy about the Packers. There's nothing.
This is one of the highest Packer scoring games in a long time and also one of the most unsatisfying, so it's a weird feeling.
Yeah, it's interesting because being at the game, which it was, the Cowboy fans walked out happy because I think they expected a loss. So to walk out with a tie, they're kind of like, okay, well, it's better than losing. We thought we were going to lose. Packer fans were just like, what? We tied? I mean,
how did we not win this?
How do we not win this game? So just a really tough game all around. We now have this bye week. So we have 2 weeks to sit and wallow in the what has really been an odd last two games. After all the hope of the first two games, this mini Super Bowl drew 26.9 million viewers. It is already the third most watched game of 2025 so far. A lot of people watching this. I didn't watch it on TV, obviously. Everything I've heard is that, boy, everyone sure enjoyed the game and it was really, really enjoyable to watch, I guess. What did you think?
If you were not a Dallas fan or a Packer fan, I guess.
No, I think Dallas fans are actually pretty pleased and were actually fairly happy to watch this game because they didn't expect to really be in it. I mean, every Dallas fan I knew that I spoke to did not expect anything like this. You know, they expected to be run over. So for them, I could see why they would leave the game feeling pretty good about it, you know. For Packers fans, the complete opposite. I mean, you know, the Packers just always, they find a way in these games. You know, we've played four games, and there's been one game where they played complimentary football, and that was the game against the Lions. Ever since then, at least one unit, sometimes two at the same time, have failed to do their job. This game, it was two at the same time, the defense and special. A deadly combination, offsetting the fine job that the offense did, right? So, complimentary not.
Almost the exact opposite of last week.
What's that?
I said almost the exact opposite last week.
Flipping around.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, special teams will still suck both weeks, but you know, last week it was
the
offense.
That was the one consistent, unfortunately.
Exactly. So, you know, let's talk about this. Just like Cleveland, the Packers seem to be in control. 13-0, Romeo Doubs has two touchdowns, and then this huge, huge event that just seemed to turn the entire game. It wasn't just a blocked extra point. It was a blocked extra point picked up and returned all the way down the field for the touchdown. I'm sitting here watching this like, okay, what does this mean? Do they get 1 point? Oh, no, they get 2 points. And we lose
a point.
And
they get the ball back.
And it's a three-point swing. It's a three-point swing in a game that ended at a tie at the end of regulation and at a tie at the end of overtime. A three-point swing. All you had to do was tackle the guy. And maybe, you know.
Yeah.
But no, this was huge. Yeah. Huge, huge, huge.
And it was a momentum killer. It really was. Mm-hmm. Because the Packers just looked shell-shocked after that. They couldn't regain any steam of any substance. It's like they were playing essentially catch up the rest of the game.
Yeah, it changed the whole feel of the game, you know. Things were fairly comfortable at that time, at that point, you know. But that just changed everything. And I think for sure that gave Dallas like a real lift, you know, like a momentum boost, so to speak, in that game.
Well, and of course it did, because it went from being 13-0, should have been 14-0, and within minutes, it's halftime, and they've scored two more touchdowns.
And they get the ball back.
And the ball back at the start of the third quarter. Mm-hmm. Where does this, I mean, we're going to talk about this more in the second quarter, but this is almost kind of this mini cosm of the first four games. We're doing just fine for the first half, and then all of a sudden at the last minute, we can't handle these last few minutes before halftime, these last few minutes before the end of the game. It just comes apart. Cleveland, it was the last 4 minutes, a complete meltdown that allowed Cleveland to win. Why can we score, or why can we do so well for the first 80% of the half, and the last 20% of the half, we look like a JV team out there?
Well, it almost felt like LaFleur was trying not to lose and not necessarily try to win. And I saw a lot of people comment on that on Twitter. Yeah, or not Twitter, on social media, because I was on another platform. And yeah, it sounds kind of cliche, but we can break down that really stupid, was it a draw pull? No, it was a screenplay that didn't go well. And they ate so much clock. It was like, are you trying to eat the clock to kick a ball, or are you trying to put it in the end zone? Because it really felt like they were just trying to kick the ball.
Well, yeah, and you know, he played a little scared of the Dallas kicker in some of those situations, you know. Worried so much about field position and the leg that the what's his name, Aubrey, has for the Cowboys, and it influenced some of his decisions.
Which comes down to play your game. Don't play someone the game the other team wants you to play. They wanted us to play scared, and congratulations, you did.
So a lot of blame, you know, perhaps somewhat rightfully placed on Jordan Love, but the reality is, dude played a great game. I mean, dude balled out. Yeah, he was passing short, and maybe they felt like maybe we weren't pressing quite as much, but you can't ask more of a quarterback to go 31 for 43 for 300-plus yards, three touchdowns, no interceptions, but all people can focus on is the strip sack that came at the end of that first half. And is that
somehow
that is
somehow
fault.
That's his fault,
right? Even
somehow.
even though the offensive line is playing Matador with the bull and saying, "Yep, go on
and
through."
The player is coming from behind him, you know, so not in his field of vision either. But somehow that's his fault. I had some interesting conversations with people on that.
You're right, CD. I think the offensive line did Love no favors. You can really tell the difference without Zach Tom there. And God willing, he's better in the next 10 days. Yeah, the line was struggling the whole day or whole evening. And that made Love more panicky. That made him throw some kind of stupid plays. There was an interception that wasn't because it got called back, thank goodness. But you had some of these situations where Love is running for his life and running backwards again. Somebody teach him how to eat a sack with the least amount of yards lost. It's like, quit trying to save yourself. Just sometimes just collapse. I'd rather have him lose 3 or 4 yards than try to pull it out of his butt, and then you're suddenly looking 13 yards in the hole.
We actually cheered him a couple times because he did throw it away. I was like, oh.
Yes, it's like, please,
as opposed
throw
to Cleveland
it away.
Where he ate that really bad one. So I think he did play a much better game. And the reality is, guys, we scored 40 points. 40 points from the Green Bay Packers with Jordan Love there. Not that Dallas has a great defense, and I think they'd be the first to admit it. The problem is the Packers do have a great defense, which also gave up 40 points. And I think a lot of credit has to go to Mr. Dak Prescott. I know Jersey Allen and I spoke about that last week, and I said, these Cowboys really think Prescott something special. He sure had a special game, as well as did Jordan Love.
Yeah, I mean, that was the best I've seen Prescott play.
Yeah,
sure.
It was very. He was very clean. He wasn't panicky.
But they had. You got to give credit to Dallas and the offensive coordinator, because they had a great plan. How do you offset a pass rush? Don't hold the ball for more than 2 seconds. Get the ball out right away. Right, and that's what he did. I mean, he was so good at getting the ball out just before somebody was about to get to him. So the pressures were there from the Packers. The sacks weren't, but the pressures were there. I mean, Parsons had 10, he's credited with having 10 on his own, but Dak just did a great job getting the ball out. And that goes to the routes that they were running and always having a hot receiver and, just smart offensive game plan. So kudos to Dallas for that.
And I will credit Micah Parsons for the Packers not losing that one, kind of sack. They call it a sack. It was for
chasing him down from the other side of the field.
He would have been in the end zone.
That was a touchdown for sure.
Yeah. So Parsons did his job. It's like some of the other defense did not. It didn't help that Devontae Wyatt went out, and we'll talk about him later. But suddenly our super scary defensive line was down one person.
And, and definitely I think they talked a little bit about how many downs those front seven guys were playing. They weren't getting breaks. They didn't have a good rotation going. By the time they got to the end of the game, that defensive line was beat. Absolutely beat.
They were exhausted.
Yeah. One thing I think that's interesting, and I mentioned this last week, and this is me once again being magnanimous. You're welcome. You're welcome, everybody. Last week I kind of said, you know what? Yeah, the Packers gave the Browns the game on a silver platter, but they had to make some pretty amazing plays in order to do it. There was at least two plays where Dak Prescott threw up an absolute prayer. And we're sitting there in the stadium. Of course, I'm sitting up, somewhere around 1,000 feet up in the air from the actual gameplay. And I'm like, there's no way that receiver was in bounds. And he was. Yeah. I mean, those were amazing plays. They had to execute miracles. I think what they said, Next Gen Stats said that it was the lowest possible percentage, that one play that where he came back, where the receiver came back from the end zone. Mm-hmm. And so it was like a 7.3% chance of completing that pass, and they completed it. I mean, Dallas did what they had to do. Yes, the Packers sort of stunk it up at times and gave it to them, and I think we've really exposed some of our weaknesses in the secondary, because when our front seven is not able to put pressure on the quarterback and that gets out, we saw what happens. They are able to complete passes against their secondary, but they did it. And I'm going to give the Cowboys credit for that.
And that's one thing with the secondary. It's like Keyshawn Nixon was either red hot or he was standing in the end zone with his thumb up his you-know-what. It seemed like he was lost on some plays on that one score later in the game, and he was just kind of standing there watching.
Carrington Valentine in particular, every time I looked down there, number 24 was just flailing. He gave up 5 receptions on 5 targets, 72 yards and a touchdown, 3 Dallas touchdowns in the fourth quarter in overtime. And, Micah Parsons said it, giving up 40 points is unacceptable and pissed off.
And he should be.
This was a defense that we just said is going to get us to a Super Bowl. Didn't look like it.
Not for this game. It's just one game.
It is. So I guess takeaways from this, we're going to kind of get into the second quarter here a little more with our blame game, hopefully. Packers offense was good enough to win. Defense and special teams pretty much gave that game away. And really the coaching and the game management is something we're going to talk about here in the second quarter. Jersey Al, you talked about it in terms of what a team has to do. I call it 4x4x4. You have to have four squads, offense, defense, special team, and coaching present for four quarters. You know, it doesn't mean they can't make mistakes. You want them there, but that did not happen against the Cowboys. Did not happen against Cleveland. So, absolutely. So that'll take us to the end of the first quarter. We're going to call this one a loss. Let's get in to quarter number two. So we are now looking at where to place some of this blame. And right now, if you are on the social media, I think it's pretty easy to see where it's going. Matt LaFleur probably has fallen from grace as far as he has fallen since he was hired. Obviously, Rich Bisaccia, the special teams coach, under an equal amount of fire. But again, that comes down to Matt LaFleur as the head coach to then make changes. Special teams do have to follow to him as the head coach. Let's talk a little bit about what's being said about Matt LaFleur and talk about how we feel about that. So, number one, what are the criticisms of Matt LaFleur right now?
I think there was a lack of urgency, especially in overtime. Granted, the rules have changed. They score a touchdown, we still get a chance if I read it right. But it didn't seem like there was this urgency to score a touchdown. Yeah, the clock management was kind of crummy at the end. Some of the play calling was a little too non-aggressive, for lack of a better term. They almost ran out the clock, screwing up that second-to-last play. They were lucky there was a little time left to kick a field goal. But it just seemed like he wasn't playing like it was overtime. I don't know if I'm making my point, but it seemed like he was playing like in the second quarter. We got a lot of time to catch up, but you only had like 3 minutes left, and you have to score. And I feel like they settled for a field goal.
Well, here's the thing. It comes down to communication, because Matt LaFleur said, well, he thought they were in the 2 minute offense, but he's not sure that the players realized they were in the 2 minute offense with the way they were handling it and the way they were taking their time getting up to the line of scrimmage. So that's still on LaFleur. What I'm saying is it's not planned. Not that he dictated the pace. I think that the players did, but because there was a communication issue with LaFleur. So it's his fault, yeah, but not directly on the field. Now, you look at next to last play before they kicked the field goal. Think about how lucky they were, mm-hmm. right, to have 1 second left. So many things could have happened there, right? The ball could have sailed into the end zone. Well, they're not going to have a second left if the ball sails into the end zone. You know, Golden could have tried to make that catch and pull. You weren't going to have a second left. The only thing that could have happened to save them was it hit that guy in the back and fall to the ground. And that saved them the 1 second. So we could very easily be here talking about a loss. And typically, you know, that could be like go down in the annals of bad losses in Packers history, right? And probably break the top 10, because there are so many of them. But
instead, it just goes down as one of our bad ties. So yeah, much shorter list.
The only bad tie.
Yeah.
Oh, they're all bad ties. There was that Vikings tie a handful of years ago. That was the kiss your sister game.
Oh, drink.
Drink.
I know. Well, it was called that at the time.
I know. Yes.
And that was a game I was at that was very unfulfilling. It just, like I said, I think they lacked a sense of urgency. And the aggressiveness just was not there. You weren't like hiking down. You know, I think they did not use their timeout at the right point. They took too much time in the huddle a couple plays ahead. And it's like the clock was still ticking. Like, do they need to work on their 2 minute drill?
The weird part is that I do think that play Jersey Al was just talking about, that pass in the middle, that was about as aggressive as you're going to get. I mean,
until that point, it was not there,
but the
though.
The point is, that was the only shot they had. So they got down to 6 seconds.
To try that with 6 seconds left is a little bit risky.
Yeah.
Because it was the play before that where they just wasted so much clock.
Yeah.
Yeah, they took their sweet time getting that play off, running it down to 6 seconds.
Right. So, obviously, Matt LaFleur interviewed after the game. Everyone is upset about this. He comes back with this explanation again, that he says, yes, that was poorly managed. Once again, kind of talking about it like it's third person. Like, yeah, that was a, you know, the game call sucked. And, you know, again, it's this weird thing like, no, this is your doing. This is what you are supposed to be doing. And we talked about it last week, and it's happening again. The times that 4th and 2 on the opening drive, he punted instead of going for it. The block kicks are obviously, this has made a difference in the last two games. The decision to put in Brandt Banks at the quote-unquote tight end spot instead of, you know, some of the people that are supposed to be there, that ends up with the block and then didn't adjust it until after the block.
But that was Musgrave.
Right.
Missed the block.
Exactly.
So it wasn't Banks. It was Musgrave.
Right.
But, yeah, they had guys like Elgton Jenkins sitting on the bench, Tucker Kraft sitting on the bench. You know, better blockers than Musgrave. Who knows about Brad Banks? But the key thing is, yes, the exact same thing happened the kick before, and it almost got blocked. And they just left the operation the same. And, well, this time the Cowboy player said, well, hey, they're doing the same thing. I'm just going all out. And he blocks the kick.
Matt LaFleur says, if I knew it was going to end like that, we would have gone faster.
Well, no kidding. Oh, my God. That's like the most Captain Obvious thing ever.
Yeah.
And when he says stuff like this, it's like, it makes me want to set my hair on fire. Right. It's like, these are just these empty platitudes about, hey, coulda, woulda, shoulda. Well, it's your job to get it right the first time. Yes, we learn from our mistakes, but it's like, we're just going to say, yeah, I screwed up. Well, what are you going to do about it to fix it? Because obviously it didn't fix it with the kick protection.
So are these beefs valid? Clock management, LaFleur even admits it. He says, my clock management, it's humbling. It's unacceptable. He even said it's like a slow motion car crash. So
well, that was describing the last few plays
exactly.
The last play specifically in overtime.
Mm-hmm.
Where
so how did they correct it?
He was sitting there watching the clock run down, feeling like it was a slow motion car crash.
Right.
So how did they correct that? Did they work on the 2 minute drill and try to get it in like a minute 45? Just really try to really hone in on that urgency, make it a minute drill. Well, how do you correct that? You've coached, Al.
Well, here's the thing: they practice the 2 minute drill so much during training camp that's like one of the main things that they focus on. Okay, you listen to people who are there at camp talk about it. Well, they're in 2 minute drill again. They're in 2 minute drill again. But there's also a something called the no huddle drill, which is kind of like a more relaxed speed up, right? LaFleur made a comment thinking that, well, maybe the players thought they were in the no-huddle drill instead of the two-minute drill, which, again, comes back to communication.
Isn't it his job to convey that to
the players? Yes, that's the communication. Absolutely.
You can't be psychic when you're on the field. You have to have, this is our plan. This is what we're going to do. You know, if you're going to go no-huddle, it has to be absolutely scripted. These are the plays we're going to do in order. Just kind of like McCarthy would do sometimes. But it just, the fact that I did not communicate well, it's like you're a head coach. You should have learned how to communicate years ago.
Well, and I think one of the interesting points that came up that on the Twitter some people tended to agree with is we have the youngest team in the NFL. And is Matt LaFleur coaching, or at times does it feel like he's babysitting? Obviously, they got some responses, but is there some truth to this, guys, that this is still an immature team? The leaders you're looking at are people like Jordan Love, who's, what, in his fifth or sixth year, or Micah Parsons, who's only like in his third or fourth year. There's not a lot of veteran leadership on this team, and, you know, it affects the locker room. It affects what's happened on the field.
They're young, but they have experience. They've played. You know, a lot of them have played two, three, four years. They're still young, but it's not like they're all rookies, you know.
Right.
But when you have a young team, the onus is on the leadership, the coaches, to really convey expectations, to convey a plan. There's a difference between coaching like high school football and little tiny kid. Little tiny kid, you have to explain a lot of things. So if the communication is, yeah, I could see a younger team struggling with communication, but then the burden is on the coach to convey that expectation and that game plan. You can't assume they're going to figure it out because this type of fluidity, this type of instinctual play comes with time and experience. Yes, this is Jordan Love's, sixth year in the league, but he's only 27. He's only had 3 years of active play. Like you said, Micah Parsons is, three or four? He's younger. Yeah, they're good, but they still need guidance from a coach. You know, if you don't have the elder statesman on the field, like you even have your super spy, Quay Walker, he's still pretty young. That leadership, if you don't have the leadership on the field, then that is shifted to the coach.
Ooh, I'm exhausted after that. I do think that part of this aggressiveness, part of this ability to raise yourself to the level of a team, there is a reason why after week two, I said, you know what? We played against two playoff caliber teams, two NFC championship caliber teams, won both of them. But I want to see how we do against a team that is middling, to see if we play down to the level, because Jersey Al, yes, that is what this young team has done with their veteran experience. They have consistently played down to the level of their opponents. And then we find out in the last 2 weeks, that's still there. So how do you take this veteran leadership when the veteran leadership is used to playing down to the level of their opponents? Because that's what we're seeing happen again.
I don't know what to say about that.
It was a rhetorical question. It's fine.
Yeah, okay, good. So I really have no further comments.
It's excellent, excellent. So,
well, I think it's important that, like, especially veteran players and young players alike, don't believe their own BS. You know, you're only good as the team you're playing against. So, if we were all calling it like it might be a blowout, are they thinking that in their own head? Oh yeah, it's gonna be a cakewalk. We should be able to clobber them. If you underestimate your opponent, you're gonna lose a lot of the time. You have to play like you're playing a Super Bowl caliber team every week, or you're gonna get torched.
So let's look at some of the fixes, because we do have a bye week, and it seems like a pretty ideal time that you'd really like to come out of this in week six and say, oh, look, we fixed the problems. However, that has not also been a hallmark of Matt LaFleur teams in the past either. But if you look at some of the bye week fixes, obviously, as Jersey Al said, communication, tempo, practicing true two-minute drill practices. LaFleur himself says it's got to be every week, not once in a while. Getting your personnel figured out for blocking on field goals and PATs, and getting your play calling rhythm, those are the easy fixes. But there are harder fixes, and I guess what do you guys see those being, and can we get those done?
Well, the hard part about the special teams thing is that there's really no live special team work done in practice. It just isn't done, right? They don't line up a bunch of guys on defense and try to block the kick. It's just
maybe they
done.
Should. It's maybe just, they should.
Well, no, you have the problem with the padded practices and the CBA and how it's just not practical anymore in the year 2025 to do stuff like. I mean, there really isn't any live hitting in practices either, right? So that's the thing. It's really a lot of it is just done walkthrough, and most of it is all just done walkthrough. So it's not the simplest thing to say, well, let's just fix it in practice, because you can't really practice somebody trying to, you know, disrupt your setup there. That's the hard part.
So you hit on earlier that the special teams for the kick, you know, for the field goal attempts, you had kind of your B and C team playing. You know, there was no Jenkins, there was no Tucker Kraft. Do we have to put in more experienced and aggressive personnel until these other guys can figure it out?
Well, here's the thing. There was a very interesting discussion on Cheesehead TV with Justice Mosqueda. He's a guy that's all about special teams, right? He's one of these people. He actually tracks special team snaps during preseason and things like that. So he's really, really into it. He's coached some special teams, albeit at the high school level, but still. And he has spoken, according to him, to many special teams coaches on the college level and the NFL level. And his take on it all is that, in reference to what you just said, that decision is not up to the special teams coach. It's up to the head coach, whether the head coach will allow certain frontline players to be on special teams. So that's something that Matt LaFleur has to do. Not Rich. Everyone's going to, you know, criticize Rich Bisaccia, but it's really not up to him which players are made available to him to use on special teams, which I didn't know. So I found that pretty interesting. So is there an easy answer? No, there is not.
So, Al, if you were the head coach, would you play the personnel that is currently on the field, or would you bring in some of those other players like Jenkins and Kraft?
Well, something like that specific unit, right, where we're talking about blocking. I'm not worried about guys getting injured. You know, if you're talking about putting your starting cornerback returning kicks or something like that, you're worried about injuries there, and rightfully so. But we're talking about just standing on the line and just blocking. I'm going to bring in the best offensive lineman that I have. Now, unfortunately, they're missing a couple offensive linemen, right? They're down Zach Tom and Aaron Banks and Jacob Monk, and I'm not sure if there's somebody else either that they're missing. So the number of offensive linemen available to them has been reduced. So that's part of the problem, too.
So one block kick, I would say, is bad luck. Two in close proximity sounds like you've got a problem.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think another place we can look at this is the fact that we still have Matthew Golden returning punts, which, by the way, the groan that went through that entire stadium when he decided to do the middle school spin move and just about had his soul leave his body.
Yeah. Oh, he time traveled with that one, no doubt.
And I don't understand this, because the Packers had an extra roster spot that they went into the game unfilled, and then they let Mecole Hardman go, who should be a reliable enough returner that you can keep your golden boy safe. He's averaging, what, 4-point-something yards per return anyway. I'm pretty sure Mecole Hardman can field the ball cleanly and return it for 4 yards, and we don't put a guy who's never returned punts in his life, Matthew Golden, continually into the situation. So talking about what you're just speaking about, Jerziel, that's another mysterious thing that I don't get.
So here's a question. Is this the same situation like you were talking about, Al, where the head coach decides, or is this one where Bisaccia would get to say, you're returning kicks, you're returning punts?
Well, Bisaccia can say, these are the players I'd like to give that opportunity, but the head coach can say, no, I don't want that guy doing it.
So what the heck is LaFleur thinking? Your first round draft choice. Let's see if his head can get knocked off. Just seems foolhardy.
Yeah, that situation is, I think a matter of numbers at the position groups, right? Because your best option really would be Keyshawn Nixon, right, to put him mm-hmm. there.
And he does a serviceable job doing it.
That's why he would be your best option. But what happens if your starting cornerback comes? What's the Packers' depth like at cornerback? Not very good, is it, right? So if he goes down, it actually impacts you more than if Matthew Golden goes down. Because if you've got plenty of wide receivers, you may not like it that your first-round pick has gotten hurt doing that, but at least you have more people that can step in and take his place. That's not the case of cornerback currently on this Packers.
Which is probably why they aren't even trying Bo Melton to do it, too, then.
Yep. Has he ever? Well, I think they tried him in preseason, maybe.
I remember him doing it somewhere, and I just don't remember where.
It might have been one or two tries in preseason. I don't know. That's the best I can think of. But
so do they need to bring in somebody just to field kicks like they've done?
You mean after they just got rid of somebody that could just field kicks?
Oh, well, that was frustrating.
Now you got to think something else happened there.
Yeah,
you got to think that wasn't a football decision.
He made somebody mad.
Yeah, in my opinion, he was griping. He was grumbling. This is total conjecture. Don't come at me, anybody. Something. He was a disgruntled employee type thing, and they said, okay, fine.
And if history shows teaches us anything, that's the quickest way to get sent out, traded out, or just cut by the Packers, whether it was Ty Montgomery, Eric Stokes.
Yeah, very true.
Definitely.
You grumble, you're gone.
All right, so we are going to finish up the second quarter here. We're going to call this a loss. Matt LaFleur.
Everything's a loss today.
Yeah. Everything's a loss. Everything hurts.
Matt LaFleur under fire, and maybe the first time, because I think you guys know I tend to be a bit of a I tend to defend players and coaches maybe more often than not, but this one's a little justified. He's got some changes to make, and if he doesn't do it, I mean, this is a season of promise, right? A season of promise that could go down pretty quickly. So that is the end of the second quarter. We are 0-2. We're going to go in the locker room and try to figure out our brains. While we're doing that, please listen to this message from our sponsor.
Do you want to experience the thrill of a Packers game at Lambeau Field? If so, be sure to get your guaranteed authentic tickets from theticketking.com, a longtime trusted source and local Green Bay business. Just go to PackersTalk.com/tickets for more information and ticket links. That's PackersTalk.com/tickets.
Welcome back, Cheesehead Radio. My name is CD Angeli, Tundervision on social media. We are talking about this Dallas Cowboy debacle. I am joined by Kelly Hodgson, that Packer Girl on social media, and of course, the amazing Jersey Al Bracco, Jersey Al GBP on social media. And we're going to get into quarter three. All right, guys, we are looking at a nice break. I think we need it. Definitely need some time off here. Let's talk a little bit about what is happening with our injury situation. How are we doing with this right now?
We have hurt people. So let's start with Devontae Wyatt. He went out, came down on his knee, didn't really get a good look at what happened, but they say he's week to week, which tells me it's probably a MCL medial collateral ligament. So which is a common knee injury. That's where you sprain your knee on the medial, so inside edge of your knee. It's not catastrophic like an ACL. It doesn't tend to cause a lot of significant swelling, but this type of injury comes down to pain. You've got plenty of function. So when he's not hurting, he can play. So hopefully by next week, he'll be able to play. And then you have Josh Jacobs, and everyone's like, oh my God, he's gone. And I remember getting texted by friends, where did he go? I'm like, I don't know. He got gashed after he got cleated. Bleeding enough that they couldn't just slap a band-aid on. He had to go to the locker room for stitches. There's no structural damage. I do not expect this to affect him in any way, shape, or form. In fact, he went to play afterwards. A gash to your leg, they usually do stitches in 7 to 10 days. They'll come out. He'll be fine. It'll be completely healed. I'm not worried about him at all.
And a little news on Marshawn Lloyd there, correct?
Marshawn Lloyd has a hamstring injury and went on injured reserve. He's eligible for return post-bye, so he could end up into the rotation. So he's been gone for a while, and I kind of forgot about him, but he might be back next week.
With that really positive offensive output we had on Sunday, really saw the running game kind of come back. I mean, you saw Josh Jacobs come in, 86 yards, 2 touchdowns. Emmanuel Wilson, when he was in there for the injured, Jacobs was very strong. That's all very, very positive.
And then if you look at the wide receivers, you've got Christian Watson. Again, this edge of review, he tore his ACL in January of this past year. They're talking about a window during the bye of returning to practice.
Possibly,
which means he's closer to playing than not. He's eligible for activation in week 6 against the Bengals. I don't see him going right into action. They're going to ease him back in. But if he starts playing, you might see a couple plays here and there, and I think that's encouraging.
They have 3 weeks where he can practice, before they actually have to add him, to the roster. So they're not going to rush him, that's sure.
No. So you'll see him more and more in practice. You'll hear more about him from the beat reporters. And when he's getting a lot more traction with the media, you can tell he's getting closer to playing, reading the tea leaves. Then other things to talk about. There are always Romeo Doubs trade rumors. This time it's to the Giants.
Starting again?
Yes, but I also saw another thing floating around social media. So it's like a lot of these garbage sites will just put clickbait. Mm-hmm. So is it clickbait or not? They're not going to get rid of him, even though there's rumors. There's also rumors I saw today that they're going to extend him. So who the heck knows? My guess is we're not going to get rid of him. He's an impact player right now. He just scored a hat trick. We're not going to trade him.
Yeah.
And then you've got Jaden Reed still out with his collarbone. And a foot injury, earliest he can return is week 8. It all depends on his foot. The collarbone will be fine by then. If they like, when I talked to one of my podiatrist colleagues, he said if he had a Jones fracture and had a pin put in, he'd be out for the season. So that's a person kind of an expert prognosticating. It's going to come down to how his foot's functioning. And then Matthew Golden, is kind of picking up the slack. He's starting to show some flashes of speed and accuracy. With Reed gone, Watson still a few weeks out, I expect expect Golden to really start stepping up even. So should we switch over to the offensive line?
We should.
All right, Zach Tom is still out with a torn oblique. That's the diagonal muscle on your abdomen. Brenton Cox out. Well, that's not one. I'm jumping ahead. Sorry, wrong count. You have Aaron Banks and Anthony Belton. Those two are expected back after the bye. So hopefully the line is not as porous. My hope is Tom will have enough time to recover. I still think last week when they put him in for all in one play, it was too soon. But the Packers have also released Brant Banks, who was picked up by the Titans. So we're still thin, but hopefully we'll start getting people trickling in within the next couple of weeks. So switching over to the defense as far as injuries go, you still have Colin Oliver with a hamstring. He's on the PUP list right now. He's eligible to return return after the bye, so we might be able to see him if he's ready to go. Brenton Cox with his groin injury, who's still on injured reserve, is earliest predicted week is week 7. And then we still have the secondary issues. They're not so hot right now. Cobbs and Valentine's were targeted heavily. Do you guys think Gutekunst might start looking for cornerback trade options?
That's one possibility.
Is there anybody out there that would be...
Well, we've got Asante Samuel rumors.
Oh, really? I didn't see that.
Yeah, this week, but evidently he had some kind of injury and he was going for a CT scan to see how it was progressing or whatnot. So I don't know how valid that really is. Anyway.
And one thing we didn't touch on is still Micah Parsons in his back. If you see him when he's not playing, he's sitting on a stationary bike. He's trying to stay loose. So that tells me his back isn't 100%.
Yeah. Well, the bye hopefully will do him.
So, excellent job. Looks like our injury situation hopefully will be improving. It certainly can't get worse. But take a look at the big picture as we're kind of going out here, taking a look at the NFC North. Tie never really does seem to help you, does it? It feels like a loss when it comes to things. You do have to remember, the Green Bay Packers are 2-0 in the conference. We're 1-0 in the division. Both of these, well, sorry, 1-0 and 1 in the conference. It's not a bad place to be. We got the wins where we really needed them. We'd love to have this one last week, but we didn't get a loss in the conference yet, so that's good. The Lions, unfortunately, even though we've beat them, are now 3-1. They're ahead of us in the NFC North. They are top 10 both offense, defense, league-leading 14 sacks. The Vikings and the Bears both now sit at 2-2, and I'm a little surprised by that because they both look very shaky, but they've both managed to sneak out some wins. So it does put us once again in a division with no teams with a losing record. Craziness.
And I think it's a little reassuring watching the last Vikings game and watching the Bears. We've struggled, but things could be worse. We could be them. Because I think they've got bigger problems in a grand scheme of things than the Packers do. I think the Packers, with a little more discipline, can improve. You can't fix a hot mess, and you can't fix the Vikings quarterback.
All right. Well, I think that's going to take us to the end of the third quarter. Now it is time for this week's Hot Pockets. Come on! Are you ready for another hot take from your Cheesehead Radio co-host? Sit back as we take to our soapboxes to give you one last soul-bearing reflection on your Green Bay Packers. Jersey Al, as always, we will start with you.
All right. My hot pocket this week is something I've talked about many times, the importance of playing situational football. The Packers are a really good team, led by a really good coach, but I continually am left scratching my head as I try to understand why they do some of the things they do at the time they choose to do that. I've ranted before about taking deep shots to covered receivers on 3rd and 4 when a simple short pass or a first down keeps the drive alive, but this is not about that. I'm specifically talking about what LaFleur did at the end of the first half. Now, I'm totally on board with trying to get in field goal range. And when you get the ball with 41 seconds left and you have a timeout, that's fine. But once they got a first down, they used a timeout and then get a 5-yard penalty. They're now facing a first and 15 on their own 27 with no timeouts and only 21 seconds. Holding a 4-point lead, you just take a knee there and go to the locker room. LaFleur has since admitted that that's what normally he would do there, but he didn't. He made an emotional decision to chase points because he was severely pissed about what had just previously transpired. It was the wrong move for the specific situation they were facing, and one that LaFleur cannot let happen again. And that is my
Hot Pockets.
So it's pretty easy. If you keep burning your hand on the hot oven, stop touching the oven. In the same vein, if your kicking game is killing you, stop kicking. Back-to-back blocks have literally been the difference in a loss and a tie in the Packers' record. Not to say there weren't other things afoot on the offense or defense in those games, but let's be real. I can't remember the last time a kick was even blocked for the Packers at all, much less two in two consecutive games. LaFleur's catchphrase is all gas, no breaks. If Matt LaFleur wants to recommit to both that mantra, as well as send a clear shot across the bow to Rhys Bisaccia, the Packers need to treat anything on the opponent's side of the 50-yard line as four-down territory. As far as I'm concerned, this includes PATs. It's time to go for two consistently. At least you don't make it. We don't spend 20 minutes arguing over the blocking patterns that are supposed to be on field goals. Send your team out there and let Jordan Love work his magic. In the end of halftime in the game, put the ball in Jordan's hands with pre-called two-minute menus and let the kid cook. Is it unconventional? Of course. But where has conventional gotten us the last 2 weeks? As Q said in the finale of Star Trek The Next Generation, we wanted to see if you had the ability to expand your mind and your horizons, and for one brief moment you did. And for that one fraction of a second, you were open to options you'd never considered. That's the exploration that awaits you, and hopefully that is the Packers team that awaits us on the other side of the bye. And that is my
Hot Pockets!
Wow.
So I guess
Star Trek philosophy there, huh?
There we go.
Amazing.
So this is kind of a message to Matt LaFleur or anyone else in Packer leadership. Stay mad, but have a plan. As much as I frequently joke about being meaner than Rich Bisaccia and throwing my hat in the ring to be a special teams coach, it's not that I can do it because I can't. It's because there's a continued acceptance of repeated mistakes and poor quality on special teams that drives me nuts. And I'm actually pretty critical about poor quality. I'm sick of empty cliches from the coaching staff. Yes, find that hot piss. Embrace the red ass, all gas, no break, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Play the cliche bingo as long as you get mad and demand better, because anger only gets you so far. Have a stinking plan. If the kicker keeps getting blocked, you have some significant problems protecting it. What is your plan to fix it? Do you have the right personnel? And if you aren't changing how you protect, you identify players who can stop that block and start practicing to anticipate the worst, even if it is a run through or a walk through. If you're not changing anything, you're just perpetuating the inefficiencies and mistakes. It may feel like the meme of the right now. It feels like you're a meme, like that guy poking with a stick that says, do something, be hungry, be angry, but God almighty, do something more than say it's something to work on. Hold the special teams to a higher standard. Lead, follow, or get out of the way, but most importantly, lead. And that is my
Hot Pockets.
All right. Well, we're going to call that a loss, too. So we are 0-4, which is funny that we're 0-4, but the Packers had a tie. I mean, I don't know what else you can do at this point.
So thank you so much for joining us tonight on Cheesehead Radio in our 17th season. Cheesehead Radio and all Packers Talk podcasts can be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also now watch two of our podcasts as live video streams on YouTube. Search for Packers Talk Network on YouTube and be sure to hit the subscribe button. You can also find us on Siri, Alexa, or Google just by saying Play Packers Talk Podcast. Finally, please follow at Packers Talk Net across all social media platforms. And remember to support our sponsor, Ticket King, for all your ticket needs. Just go to PackersTalk.com/tickets for details. Oh, thank God it's a bye week. That's a wrap, guys. Go Pack Go.
Enjoy the bye. We'll see you next week.
Go Pack Go.
Go Pack Go.